Okay, welcome everybody. Tonight's class is a special class. Actually, this is a class I gave over Shavuot. It's called Profit versus Principles, Exploring Jewish Business Law in Real Life Scenarios. So we're going to do about 5 to 10 different scenarios, learn the basic halachas around it, and it's just an opportunity to bring, as you know, on the Seres HaDibros, the first side of the Dibros are mitzvot that are bein Adam la'makom, are between ourselves and Hashem. And the second half of the Seres Dibros, you know, 6 through 10, is bein Adam l'chaveiro, between ourselves and our fellow man. And this area of business law applies bein Adam l'chaveiro, which of course, in fact, is also bein Adam l'makom. But let's go into it. So I'll do a share screen. Here we go. All right, so Moshe Chaim Doz starts off with reading this scenario number one, called Buy on Sale, Return on Retail.
Question. I bought children's clothing at a store that was running a 30% off sale on its merchandise. When I got home and tried them on my children, one of the outfits didn't fit. A while later, after the sale ended, I was passing by the store and brought the item back for a refund. Since I did not have my receipt, the clerk assumed that I had paid the full amount listed on the tag, and she refunded the full amount. Am I allowed to keep that money, since that is the value of the outfit, or am I required to inform them that I received it at a discounted price?
Okay, what do you guys say?
You have to tell them about the mistake, right?
Yeah, there's no way it's okay to keep the money.
No,
No.
no way. Even if it's not your fault, you still have to, because the person might get in trouble. They could get fired.
I mean, we can sort of see the bottom of the source sheet, but it's theft by deception. I mean,
Right, correct. So you're already checking that, right? So if it was in Hebrew, you would have a be able to hide it better. Yeah. So, all right. So we're gonna have a couple related scenarios. But first of all, we have to ask ourselves a basic question. When you analyze this in the eyes of Jewish business law, what's happening when you bring something back for a refund? What is happening halachically and legally?
You're returning ownership back to the store, like from you
So
to the store?
is that a new transaction, or is that a voiding of the first transaction?
Voiding
Voiding.
of the first.
Right, so in halacha is like this. In halacha, you have a phenomenon called a mechira al tanai. In other words, I can sell something, and I can put any caveat for that sale. So, for example, I could say that I'm selling you clothing. You have 30 days to return it if you have a problem with it, or I can stipulate what other problems are. If you return it, you get your money back. So if that's the case, if it's really a voiding of the sale and that person gets the extra 30%, what problem is that person engaged in by taking the extra 30%?
They've gotten money that they didn't have before. All they did was hold the
And
person's
what
merchandise
term
for
do we call that?
theft.
Yeah, geneva, theft. Right, that money does not belong to you. Now, another possibility is that I understand American law is actually viewed as two separate transactions. You buy the object, and then the policy is that they will, in fact, buy it back from you. Now, they're going to buy it back from you, but they're not. But a clothing store is not buying it back from you at retail. They're going to buy back to you at what you paid for it. So anything that, again, that is above that is theft. And not telling them is this issue. So without further ado, this is from the Shulchan Aruch. So Moshe Chaim, b'vakasha.
Okay. It is forbidden to deceive people with regard to a business deal or to beguile them. This prohibition applies equally to Jews and to Gentiles. The seller knows that the article he's selling has a blemish. He must notify the first purchaser about it.
All right,
One
stop
should
right
not.
there. Well, stop right there.
Okay, stopped.
So, good question. So, in America, we have the rule, buyer beware. In Jewish law, it's the reverse. It's seller beware. You cannot sell a person a car knowing that there's a crack in the engine without informing them of that crack or any defect whatsoever. You could say, if you don't know, you say, I don't know. I'm selling this car as is. I don't know. I did not do anything. You are, that's it. But, that's it. Take it. That's it. You can do that. Now, this is called, the Hebrew is genevas das, literally meaning the stealing of the mind, or what you call in English a, deception or a fraudulent misrepresentation. Okay? Genevas das. Okay. Moshe Chaim, keep on going.
All right. One should not sell a Gentile the meat of an animal which has not been ritually slaughtered, as if it were ritually slaughtered meat. So not misrepresenting its kashrut.
Yeah. So here's no. So now, but notice why does they bring down the case that it's a Gentile? In other words, a non-Jew comes into your store. You happen to have meat that you're a butcher, meat that is not kosher for whatever reason. You're going to give it to your dog, get rid of it, sell it to a non-Jewish butcher, whatever it may be. Let's assume the price of the meat is identical. So you take out the obvious Geneva problem. Why is the problem of Geneva's das? He didn't, I mean, what is the difference to him? For him, it's a steak, it's a steak. He doesn't need to be glatt kosher. What's the problem? What's the problem? I want a glad kosher steak. I want to taste it. And you sell him this one that happens to be not kosher.
It's just the misrepresentation, even if everything is equal. Like saying it's one thing and it's another, even if there's no value difference.
Exactly. Our inner world has to be like our outer world. Now, again, there are situations we've discussed on occasion where there is a, for shalom bias, lying. But here, there's not a shalom bias issue. Here, because the key thing is, one of the main principles of Judaism is our relationship to truth. And we have to be truthful. So even though he does not have the laws of kosher, he could eat a non-kosher steak. It's not a problem. Okay? But the bottom line is, he wants a kosher steak. You gotta sell him a you gotta sell him a kosher steak. That's what the guy wants. And you can't tell him this steak, which happens not to be kosher, you can't sell them it's kosher. Okay, keep on going.
One should not deceive people in a manner that one thinks that he is doing something for them when in reality they are not. For example, one should not press his colleague to share a meal with him when he knows that his colleague will not accept the invitation, nor should he press presents upon him when he knows that his colleague will not accept them.
One more case.
Okay. He should not open casks supposedly for his colleague, which he must open for sale, in order to deceive him to thinking that they've been opened in his honor. Okay. If, however, it is a case where the person, if they paid attention, they would realize that this is not being done for them, yet they fool themselves, do not have to correct them. For example, you are out on the way and the person imagines that you gave him out to show them honor, you do not have to correct them. So they think one thing that you didn't tell them was wrong. You have to make sure that they know the right situation.
Correct. So let's go back to the first case. So I want to give some modern day applications. Let's say, Scott, somebody who lives in the Upper West Side says to you, they know that this Shabbos, you're going to Florida. Okay. Yet they say, hey, Scott, could you come over? We're going to be in the Upper West Side this Shabbos. You want to come over for Shabbos? It'll be great. And then you say, I'd love to. I'm going to be in Florida. I already got booked tickets. The guy's, then I'll take a rain check. So that's awesome. Because what is the guy doing?
Right. They're trying to get credit for inviting you without actually inviting you, with like knowing that you're going to say no.
Right. Can't do that. It's a misrepresentation. In other words, you cannot get credit. So in other words, they're doing this misrepresentation, this deception, in order to accrue unearned social credit. Or next, the guy comes to Shayna. Let's say she's, I don't know, dairy intolerant. I don't know. I don't think she is. Whatever. And they have this delicious box of Godiva chocolates, and they say, Shayna, here's some delicious Godiva chocolates. Say, I'd love to, but I'm dairy intolerant. But if they knew that in advance, and then they're trying to get the credit of giving you a wonderful gift, that's usher. Or another case, scenario three, is imagine, Moshe Chaim Dov comes over to a person's house Friday night, for what do you call it, for dessert. And the person in his own mind said he had a bottle of 25-year-old scotch, which he wanted to open for his own benefit. But he sees Moshe Chaim at the door and says, "Moshe Chaim, you're coming? Nothing but the best." And uncorks the 25-year-old 25-year-old bottle of scotch. So that's awesome. They cannot do that. Now, if Moshe Chaim Doz goes to the Shalom Zachar, and on the table, they have a bottle of 25-year-old scotch, and Moshe Chaim says, "Oh, you didn't have to do this for me." They don't have to say anything. They don't have to correct you because you obviously know from context that they're having nice bottles of scotch in honor of the Shalom Zachar, and they didn't open them up for you. They don't have to look. You don't have to make sure that they are not fooled. If a reasonable person would obviously know contextually that that was not an act, a gesture of specific honor for you as one of the 100 guests at the Shalom Zachar. I'm saying you don't have to correct that. That's not. But if it's fraudulent intent, that cannot be done. Okay, two new scenarios. Okay, here we go. Cindy purchased a desk from Nordstrom's for a fancy simcha, capitalizing on their liberal return policy with the intention to wear it and then return it. Is this permitted? Why or why not? Why not?
Because it's kind of like theft, but temporary theft. Like they sell you something for $50, you hold on to it, wear it once and return it. It's kind of, it's definitely not right.
Definitely not right. It feels wrong. Now, by the way, I went on to Nordstrom's return policies page, and they have since they have a return. They're basically the return policy is you return it for any reason, we'll accept it, except for gowns. They have been, shall we say, taken advantage of one too many times. People would buy a $1,500, $2,000 dress to a fancy gala. And then people would return it. They would make sure the tags are still on. They'd tape them to the inside part of the dress so it's not obvious. And they would lightly wear it. And that's that. Red for the runway. That's good. Good to know. So that's Gnevus Das. You have no intention of buying this. Now, you're allowed to buy something like, I'm not sure if I want to buy it or not. For example, I would differentiate. For example, let's say you bought from an online shoe. Let's say you went on Amazon and saw a pair of shoes you like. And you're not sure how this Italian sizing works. So you do, let's say, 11 and a half, 12, 12 and a half. Is that Gnevus Das? So Shayna, why not, Shayna?
That's you not knowing your size necessarily in that specific brand. So you're ordering multiple sizes to identify which shoe is going to fit you the best, and then returning the one that does or the ones that don't fit.
Right. That knows there's no fooling there because if you are a online shoe seller, and you are getting the benefit of not having bricks and mortar, you know that people, in order for the sizing issue, are will often buy, one, two, three pairs of the exact same thing, and then return it. That's part of the deal. That's part of the deal. But if you will buy a dress with the intention not to use it at all, where the classic situation? Costco. What do I mean by Costco also has a very liberal return policy, and you will see on Monday, after the Super Bowl, people returning rather large screen TVs. How is that possible? Why so many TVs going back to Costco on a Monday? Well, what people do is that they get yourself a 4, 5G, gorgeous, 90-inch, plasma, you know, with all the fixings TV. Have all the chevra over. And then Monday, you cart it back to, you know, basically it's a free rental. Osser. Okay? It's Gneva's Das. And as Scott said, might even be a case of Gneva. Okay. Now, what I'm sharing with you is, by the way, the reason why I'm getting smiles from you guys, because this is not something that you've not witnessed. You have seen all this. Every one of these cases, this is not a new thing. Okay, this is a more nuanced case. Case three. Chaim purchased a premium Weber grill from a local hardware store with a 30-day return policy. On day 40, Chaim arrives at the store with an unopened box containing the grill and requests a refund. Despite the policy's expiration, may Chaim attempt to negotiate with the store to make an exception and grant them a dispensation for the refund?
Why not?
Yeah, it's unopened, completely brand new, never been used. It's a little different.
Okay, so let's say they go there and the guy and the person at customer service says, sir, I see that grill is for our company. But I see that from your receipt. That's 40 days ago. We cannot accept the policy. Can Chaim do a begging or a pressuring or making a scene to nudge him into doing it?
Those are three separate ways of doing different things.
So what do you say?
I'd say you can request it, but in terms of making a scene, no. That would be Marasayan, if nothing else.
Well, Marasayan means that means you know, Marasayan means you're doing an activity that has the look to the reasonable onlooker that you're doing something forbidden. Now you might get a Chil Hashem factor as well, but yeah. I'm just saying, but just to even discreetly to apply pressure and say, come on, John, you know. So it's interesting, halacha. This might be one of the Ten Commandments. Here we go. The Ram teaches us, says it very eloquently, like this. All right, Chaim, you're the reader tonight.
Me? Oh, okay. Anyone who covets a servant, a maidservant, a house, or utensils that belong to a colleague or any other article that I can purchase from him and pressures him with friends and requests until he agrees to sell it to him, violates a negative commandment, even though he pays much money for it. As it says, don't covet.
Right. So therefore, it could be that you are, since you're causing a unjustified pressurized sale, you're having the guy buy back his product beyond the, unlawfully. According to many authorities, that might get yourself into a low tach mode, not coveting, because you're basically, you're causing pressure. In other words, the goal of a store is to sell products and for the vast majority of them not to be returned. So to ask, nice that I know I'm not entitled to it, would you be open to extending the return policy, you know, to day 40? I'd appreciate that. That's, I think it's fine. That's not a pressuring. But to say, come on, you know, a little more brass knuckled kind of encounter at the old customer service desk, that would be a biblical violation. All right, and taking the money would be a geneva because you're not justified for it. Okay. This is some. Has anybody here had the joy of working with a contractor in a house? We got Moshe Chaim.
Mm-hmm. Okay, had our bathroom redone.
Yes. So frequently when one hires a worker to do work in your house, sometimes it comes out great. Sometimes it comes out okay. And sometimes it is in fact substandard. So let's get into the case here. So Shana, read the case.
Mr. Schwartz worked as a subcontractor. He was in the midst of a home renovation project and hired a young local plumber, Mr. Green, to install the bathtub and sink in the bathroom. Mr. Green came one afternoon and worked for a number of hours installing the bathtub and sink. He left a bill for Mr. Schwartz. The following morning, the project supervisor came by to check the progress of the renovation. I had the bathtub and sink installed yesterday, Mr. Schwartz said. I got one of the local plumbers to do it. Let's have a look, said the supervisor. I hope he did a good job. The two went to the bathroom. When the supervisor saw the work, he was furious. What kind of work is this? He exclaimed. The sink is not centered properly, and the bathtub is not sitting straight. The sealant also looks like it was applied by an amateur. I'll call him back to fix it, said Mr. Schwartz. No way, said the project manager. Everything has to be redone completely. Whoever you got, I don't trust him. Tell him that everything has to be redone and get someone else. Mr. Schwartz called Mr. Green and sadly notified him that the supervisor insisted that the work be redone by someone else. That's up to him, said Mr. Green. I left a bill for my work yesterday. Why should I pay you, said Mr. Schwartz. Your work was shoddy and has to be redone completely. I gained nothing from it. Nonetheless, argued Mr. Green, I invested time and effort installing the tub and sink. Why shouldn't I be paid? It's not my problem that you did substandard work, replied Mr. Schwartz. The two came before Rabbi Dayan. Mr. Schwartz asked, am I required to pay Mr. Green for his work?
All right, what do you say? Let's say he's charging, I don't know, $250
for... No, right? Because like, he did a terrible...
Okay, why?
Well, I mean, he did a terrible job. It's almost as like he did the job, didn't do the job at all, and he's saying I should get paid.
So he deserves $0.
Yeah, I would say that. He was contracted to do the job, you know, correctly, and he didn't.
Okay. Shayna, what says you? The choices are $0 or the $250 that's on his bill.
I feel like $250 is really low for the installation of a sink and tub.
Okay, $500. $500. Okay, $500. Okay, let me upgrade it. $500 is what he has on the bill. Because he's just doing it two inches, just installing, whatever. What do you say?
I feel like he should be given the opportunity to fix it. And then if he can't.
No, but the supervisor who's saying, I don't want this guy. This guy, he's causing more damage than he's, you know, he's, we're going to have to redo this. It's an amateur job. So I can't.
There's like three levels of subcontracting going on here. There's the owner, the project manager who's contracted to organize the job, who contracted the who subcontracted again. So it's like three levels of contract here.
So whatever, but the question is, if it's between Mr. Schwartz, who's, in other words, obviously Mr. Schwartz is paying his workers, plumbers, electricians, et cetera, from the money he receives from the owner. Does he have to pay Mr. Green or not? Or if so, how much?
I think he has to pay Mr. Green.
The full $500.
I think so, unless Mr. Green acknowledges that he'll take like a discount because the work wasn't up to standard.
All right, so you're going with
$250.
Julie, say split the difference.
Well, because if it's $500, he could take him to clean. Yeah, or say no, I'm not going to pay it, and you can take me to claims court because I believe it's $500 or more for small claims court. If I'm not mistaken, I may be wrong on the amount. So if he says. He's not going to it's likely he's not going to go through the trouble to do that. So we would take the $250.
Okay. All right. So what do you say, Moshe Chaim Dodds?
I think it's a question of who to deceive to here. And he agreed to do
a
job.
It's not a case of deception. Mr. Green tried to do it. He just did a poor job.
But he didn't do what he was contracted to do properly. So he didn't deliver on his side of the contract, so he shouldn't be paid.
All right, so you and Scott are in the not a dime. Shane is given the full $500, and Julie is splitting the difference at the $250 level. All right. All right, so good. So by the way, this is exactly what I was hoping for, is that I want to give cases which are sort of like not clear. So let's see what the halacha says in these cases. Okay, here we go. All right, Moshe Chaim, back to you.
All right. You hire a worker to deliver apples to a certain sick person. When you arrive with the package, you find the person either dead or recovered. You may not say to the worker, take the apples as your payment. Rather, you must pay the full amount.
Okay, so the Shulchan Aruch says in Chosha Mishpat 335 Sif Gimel, three, is that you hire a courier. And apparently, in the time of the Rishonim, apples were viewed of having spectacular medicinal value. You're basically
apple a day.
Right? Apple a day. You know, well, back then, I mean, you know, getting your vitamin C, you know, that was a good thing. They didn't know about that. They knew it was good stuff. So the guy shows up, and obviously the intended recipient does not need it. A, either he's dead, so obviously he's not in a position to have any apples. Or B, he's back to his health, and he doesn't need apples. The luck is the fact that the goal of the job is no longer needed. You, who hired the courier, have to pay him 100%. Okay, so I think that's pretty straightforward to everybody. So it makes no difference. The result is irrelevant. In other words, if he did his job, or if he did the job, he's got to get paid.
But I think that's where it differs, is that one case we're saying he didn't do the job, and this one, he attempted to do the job, but then the goal changed as opposed to he didn't do it. It's like if you took the apples halfway and then turned back, that would be a closer case, I would think.
Correct. So then we get to the next case. Cases like this. All right. Go ahead, Moshe Chaim.
Hold on.
I don't know. One second. Let me get it out of. Go ahead.
I can move my talents. If the sofer tells you after he has delivered the completed Sefer Torah that the hides in which the parchment was produced were not made lishma for the sake of writing a Torah scroll, he's believed to render the Sefer Torah apostle, which is invalid, since everyone knows that writing a Sefer Torah on such parchment renders the Sefer Torah apostle. He knows he is giving up all of his wages, and thus the kosher status of the Torah has been completely undermined. The sofer is still entitled to the wages of producing a chumash.
Okay.
So a lesser value.
Yes. So the thing is like this, that you hired a sofer to write you a Sefer Torah. Okay. That's going to take him 6 months. Once he delivers that Sefer Torah, that Sefer Torah has what they call a cheskas kashrus. It is viewed as a kosher Sefer Torah. That's a status. Now the question is, how can we, what is deemed to view it as, how can you invalidate that status? Well, you can invalidate the status if he's going to make a claim about the Sefer Torah that basically where he says, obviously it's not in his best interest to admit that all the parchment, the cloth, is puzzle, was not made lishma, because he knows he's going to lose 6 months of labor. He's going to lose whatever they call it 50 grand now. He's going to lose $50,000. If you want to say that, even though the thing had a what they call a cheskas kashrus, it's now completely removed. The Ramah, the Ashkenaz point brings up, says, yes, he did. He should not get the wages of a full Sefer Torah. Let's call it 50 grand. But a chumash, again, for the printing press. It just sold, one of these things actually just got sold for $38 million, $38 million, a handwritten on parchment Tanakh. So people used to read, you know, if you didn't always learn, they had a, you know, in like in a book form, or they'd have a, so they'd use the apostle one for a chumash. So that obviously has value, but obviously as Chaim says, a lower value. So let's say that's 20 grand or 10 grand or 5 grand. He gets that amount of money. Based upon this, is Mr. Green, the amateur plumber, or the plumber who had a bad day, entitled to his $500 for installing the sink and the tub? Shana says yes. Go ahead. Why? Make the case, Shana.
The last line from the Ramah, the sofer is still entitled to the wages of producing a chumash. That the plumber is still entitled to the wages for doing the job. However, you could also argue that this is a little bit different. Like perhaps in this case, like the sofer is coming forward and saying that the Torah is possible, whereas the plumber may have be saying, this is my best work. Or this is...
So you could say, see, there's two things. Right now we have two products he had delivered, either a sefer Torah or a lesser product called the Chumash. But the point is that Mr. Green had to, there is basically, you see here that you pay a person for a standard of work. In this case, either a sefer Torah or at least a Chumash. But if it was like not able to be legible, let's say, you get no money. So for that reason, Mr. Green doesn't get a dime. Because he's going to have to take it out. It's, in other words, you only have to pay for industry standard work. Now, obviously, this is where it gets a little bit gray. There is a, look, obviously, it was not center, whatever it was. But now, frequently, people get into fights with contractors because it was maybe done in an industry standard manner, but they didn't like it. Or if their standard was not an industry standard, they had a Four Seasons level standard. Okay, so that would be an area where the guy would, you'd have to pay him, even though you're not happy with the job, but it hit that threshold of industry standard. That's why the case is written nicely, because it's they brought in a project supervisor, whose sole job is to assess quality of work. So that's a very important halacha. If you hire somebody to do a job and it's substandard, you don't have to pay. Now, as Julie brought up, a very important point. Now you have to, that is called what we call the Ikara Din from the basic halacha. Now you may on your own say, I feel bad for the guy, I'll throw him some bucks, or B, I don't want to get hauled into I don't want to spend an evening at small claims court or in a basin or whatever the recourse. I'm going to give him some what they call going away money. Because I just rather pay the money and not have a hassle in life. Your time is worth money also. So therefore, not having to deal with that is sometimes it's a less of a loss. We keep on going. Sponsorship. Let me just move it over to here. Okay, all these cases I got from Rabbi Orlian from the Business Halach Institute, which has a great resource. They produce lots of great cases. I mean, they're a Basin and they provide consulting and Jewish business law, and these are cases that happen. So it's a great resource. So I picked some that I thought that you guys would like. Okay, with the Vakasha. All right, Moshe Chaim, read on.
All right, Rabbi Dayan always led the keynotes in his shul on Tisha B'Av, but was going away this year for the entire summer. The shul president and board members decided to hire an outside speaker to lead the keynotes. They arranged with Rabbi Darshan to lead the keynote and agreed on a respectable fee for the day. How should we fund the speaker? The president asked. Congregants will likely be willing to sponsor the speaker, replied the treasurer. They will miss Rabbi Dayan's inspirational words this year and will look forward to hearing Rabbi Darshan. I think you're right, said the president. Notify the congregants. I will hope for a positive response. A message was sent out. A guest speaker, Rabbi Darshan, will lead Tisha B'Av keynotes. We are seeking sponsors. Checks should be made out to the shul. The community responds generously. Within a few days, people donated the necessary amount. We should notify the congregants that we've reached the goal, said a board member. There is no need for additional sponsors. Why stop people from donating, asked the treasurer. We can use the additional amount for general shul expenses. I see this as a good fundraising cause. Then we would have to notify them that the additional money will be used for general shul expenses, countered the board member. What's the difference, said the treasurer. Let each person think that he is a sponsor. No one knows who donated first. That's misleading, said the board member. If they wanted to donate the shul expenses, they would have done so. Clearly, they wanted the speaker. I suggest that we ask Rabbi Dayan to the president. I'll call him. Do we need to alert the congregants that we've reached the goal? Can we retain the additional money for the general shul expenses?
Okay, guys, what do you say? So the case is, they call this every shul. If you are a member of a shul, you have received these emails. We're looking for sponsors for Shavuos, we're looking for this Niskan residence. An endless stream of requests for funds. It doesn't end. But sometimes there is a program that speaks to people, not lots of people. So let's say this was going to cost, let's say the speaker and whatever the expenses for the particular Dahlin residence for the whole day of Tisha B'Av is going to be $2,500. Let's just put an arbitrary number. And they send out an email blast to all their shul members, and they gather $5,000. And the treasurer, of course, notices the treasurer, is delighted. Great, we got to keep on doing this. Let's see if we can raise $10,000. Can they use the extra funds for the... So the question, it breaks down to a couple questions. Can they use the funds, the extra $2,500, can they use the funds for general shul expenses? B, can they send out another email blast to say, hey, we're looking for more sponsors for our spectacular Tisha B'Av program? What do you guys say?
So I don't believe they can.
Can what?
They can't ask for additional sponsors if they already raised money that was necessary. If it was above the amount of money that was raised, then they could just keep it, I guess, and put it towards school expenses.
Okay, so you're saying, all right, so Julie says, she says no to the next email blast, but they can use the extra $2,500 to, let's say, a kiddush or whatever they want to spend on the building fund or whatever extra chumashim, whatever they need. All right, Moshe Chaim, what do you say? What says you?
I think that they did a horrible job structuring the fundraiser. I'm going to use, and I've seen this done at both my shul and MJE, but you guys give people choices of which lines to fund for which programs. So you can, if you structure it in such a way that going to this specific line of programs, then you have to put it there. You can't just take it and then put it someplace else, both for tax and for ethical reasons.
So what are they supposed to now? So you agree with Julie, no more emails to raise money on something that's fully funded.
Not when that was the whole goal of the fundraiser.
Should they do with the extra $2,500? Return it?
Find other ways to enhance Kinos, that's in the spirit of enhancing the program, or possibly put it away for Kinos next year would be my guess.
Okay. Very good thought. Shayna, what says you, Shayna?
I don't know on this one, because I know, like, my shul did it before COVID. I think this was the first or second year that they did it again after COVID for Lag BaOmer, that they'll do a barbecue and a fire and a kumsitz in someone's backyard, and they look for donors or sponsors for it. This year they offer different levels. So we know about how much they raised, but I don't know if they broke even on the event. I don't know if they profited on the event. I don't know if the event was at a loss to the shul. They don't share that information. And I would say only the fundraising committee and the treasurer, maybe the board, actually knows. But they also, they sent out the first email probably like 2 weeks in advance. And as we got closer, they continued to send the email even up to like the day before or the day of the event. But those emails, it also included the who gave at what level.
Okay, so but the question is, let's say in this case they said the money is for, let's just remember, the money is for
the speaker for the
guest speaker at Joshua's League. We're looking for sponsors. Now they fully funded it. Now they're already in they're in the black, $2,500. So the question is, A, can they use the money for something else like a next Shabbos Kiddush? Can they, and then can they send out more emails to get additional sponsors for the Tisha B'Av speaker? What do you say, Shayna?
In regards to the emails, I think it depends on precedent previously set by that shul and how late or close to the date they go before they stop sending those emails. As for the money raised with the extra money, I think as Moshe Chaim said, I don't think they can use it to just fund school expenses, but can use it towards other things pertaining to Tisha B'Av.
Okay. Okay. So you agree with him? No more emails?
I think that depends on shul precedent. Okay. I think if you're like a week out from the event and previous events, the shul would continue sending emails up to the day before. I think it would raise people's antennas, if you will. Like, why did they stop sending out emails so early?
Okay. Scott Shapiro, what do you say?
Well, I would say it's not a bad thing to overraise for an event to put that money towards. I think I would say, like, if it cost like $2,500 and they broke even and they kept
grand. They'd one email blast, they got a tremendous response, they're already in the red black, $2,500.
I would say
cash, and do they send out more emails?
We raised way more than we expected. They should let the community know, like, we overraised for the event, and we will be using that money towards, you know, the next holiday or the Kiddush or something else. Like, they should maybe be forthcoming to let the community know, like, what the money will be used for.
If nobody's going with a treasurer, we should keep on sending more emails out so we can raise money for the school expenses. Nobody's going with that one. All right. So first of all, so first thing, there's a issue. We started our class tonight with the idea of Ganeva's Das. You cannot be deceptive. You cannot send an email which says you need money for the speaker if the speaker is fully paid for. That's Ganeva's Das, which, of course, then you get the money that's getting through a Ganeva problem. Point number one, because as Moshe Chaim suspected and is correct, in American law, we have called a restricted gift. What is a restricted gift? In America, you have a restricted gift. For example, the shul, very simple, shul has a building fund, okay? And they want to build an extension, whatever it is, they want to build a new whatever. So you give $5,000 to a building fund. They cannot take that money and use it for kiddushes or paying the rabbi's salary or paying for the heating bill from the heating company. It's got to be segregated in a separate account for the building fund. That's it. So here too, let's do a whole halacha here. All right, so Moshe Chaim, read us the last halacha of the night.
All right. When funds were collected for poor person to satisfy his lack and the collection exceeded his needs, the additional funds belong to him. Extra funds for the poor should be given to the poor. Extra funds donated for the redemption of captains should be used for that purpose. Extra funds donated for the redemption of one individual captive should be given to that captive. Extra funds donated for the burial of the deceased should be used for that purpose. Extra funds donated for the burial of an individual deceased person should be given to his heirs.
Okay, it's a very interesting halacha. So you see here that the halacha has the thing called a restricted fund. So if the community is collecting for a specific poor person, okay, you cannot, and now they need to raise 10 grand. Now they have 15 grand. They can't say, we're going to take that extra 5 grand and use it for something else. Now, it's interesting, since it's, remember, Sadaf's called a matana. You're giving it to that person as a gift. So the extra funds actually go to the ani, even though right now he's not an ani, because it's a gift to him. Now, if you're collecting a general one for a niyim, you know, a general, this is very common. So once you take care of your aniyim, the money is then what? You cannot use it for a kiddush. You cannot use it for a building fund. You need to store it away for further aniyim. So therefore, the application here is you cannot send any more emails. That's Ganeva's Das. Two, you cannot take that money and use it for a kiddush or a building fund or anything else. You could use it for the same thing, either like as Moshe Chaim said, in the next year's kiddush speaker or Tisha B'Av program, or maybe a little bit slightly more broadly, the next scholar in residence. So that's like the sort of the same category. But you have to respect the intent of the donor. Now, you can always go back to them and say, do you mind if we rededicate it? That's always allowed. But we're talking about, this is the board, as Shayna points out, in general, there is a board, and they talk about the findings. They don't discuss it with the entire shul all the time. They will, they'll talk about, when there's a ratifying the budget, they'll talk about it that one time a year. But generally, the individual transactions are just the responsibility of the people who have been voted to do that job. So the bottom line is that that's the basic halakha. The takeaway I want is that, to be the best version of a Jews that we are, it's very important to be concerned about what Hashem asks of us to do in the kitchen and how to conduct ourselves in the bedroom and how to conduct ourselves in the synagogue or in the Beit Midrash, but also how we conduct ourselves in the workplace. And these are just some basic examples, because we're doing transactions all the time. And these are areas that we have to be, be sensitive that if something is something that strikes you perhaps being a problem, find out the information if indeed is a problem. Sometimes, as you see, we had a couple cases tonight that I asked everybody and we had different opinions. Now, each person's position was quite logical. Not all this will break down to immediately common sense answers. It requires some knowledge of the basic principles of the Torah's conception of a business law in regards to, between people and businesses in general. So hopefully that was clarifying. Any questions? Any follow-up questions?
In regards to, I guess, like the trying to return something after the return policy ended, what about, I guess it would be in the similar vein, if you, for whatever reason, missed a credit card payment and you call the credit card company to ask if, because you've paid on time every time before, if they'd waive the late fee and interest fee for that one time.
No problem. You can ask, or you're not, first of all, in that case, you're not asking them to buy something back that they don't want to buy. The way they make money is by charging interest and fees. So you're saying, I'm a good customer, and I'd like you to show would you be open to show some consideration of waiving that annoying $39 fee that you charged me because I was one hour late. Okay? That's 100% fine, and not only that, I would say that one should do that. Because in rule in life, if you do not ask, you do not get. So to ask, that's fine. To pressure in the case of a buyback, could get it to issue of a low tachmod, a thou shalt not cover. Are there many cases, but just to give everybody a little taste of the action here. All right, guys, have a great night. And Scott, I might see you tomorrow. All the best. Hey,
Mazel tov.